Well, greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, and the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on 29 AM and FM radio stations 7 days a week and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on whatever happened to the American farmer right after this message. You know, when the federal income tax was launched way back in 1913, the tax was levied only on the super wealthy, the richest one-half of 1% of our population. Now, the top tax rate was only 7%. Today, of course, the fears of those early opponents of the tax have been more than fully realized. By the end of Herbert Hoover's term, the top tax rate had jumped to 60%. By the time Franklin Roosevelt was done, the top tax rate was 90%. And the tax had been dramatically expanded to seize the incomes of the middle class for the first time. Back in 1913, the average family had to work until January 30th to earn enough to satisfy the tax man. Today, the average American family will work all the way through May 12th. In order to earn enough to pay their federal tax or their federal, state, and local tax bills. Now, the income tax and Social Security tax violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant, and that includes our English common law. And the income tax and Social Security tax are two criminal activities. The income tax is the second plank to the Communist Manifesto, and Social Security is the eighth. That's why I contend that you owe it to yourself to at least ask the question, do I really want to participate in this kind of criminal activity? For more information about tax and status, why don't you call me at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, informative, and best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, just go to the website georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, last time we were talking about the guardian-ward relationship. And we're reviewing the Examiner, the Krebs Agribusiness Examiner. You can get a copy of this Agribusiness Examiner by just putting in the email request. Go to avkrebs@earthlink.net and send him your name and address. It's free. He simply asks that you help him finance the endeavor, finance the publication. I recommend $25 a month. That'd be $300 a year. Comes out weekly. It's about 18-20 pages, sometimes it's 24 pages, and there's more than a weekly publication. Oftentimes he'll put out two in a week. He normally puts out one a week. And it contains all of the current information or news in agriculture. It's an agricultural newsletter. And in this newsletter, he's reviewing a paper called the USDA Incorporated, and it's a story about how the United States Department of Agriculture is joined with the multinational corporations to form a cartel. This cartel works against the family farmer. That's its objective. That's its purpose. The purpose of the United States Department of Agriculture is to put every independent family farmer off the farm and out of business. That was their purpose in 1933. That was their purpose in 1900. It has been accomplished. There were 45 million farmers in 1920. Today, there's less than 2 million. They have succeeded in their objective far beyond their wildest expectations, I'm sure. Now, to understand the historical context from which the present-day USDA has emerged is therefore mandatory if you and I are to set about reforming this institution, because by its very nature and given its history, it cannot be reformed from within. Likewise, no center or to center attention on just five areas. Let's take a look at five. Bovine spongiform encephalopathy, that's called BSE or mad cow disease. Then captive supply in meatpacking. And then biotech foods and concentrated animal feeding. And as case studies of USDA's dereliction of duty, as does USDA Incorporated, is both myopic and exhibiting a fondness for not seeing the forest for the trees. Let's take a look. No one can argue that economic concentration and the consequences of such concentration have had a profound influence on the cattle industry and the meatpacking business. But in seeking to explain the evolution of efforts to curb such concentration, the USDA Incorporated not only fails to properly and thoroughly explain the origins of those efforts, but it overlooks their long-term consequences. It merely states that the idea that a regulatory agency would abandon its public mission in favor of a narrow one is not a new concept. In fact, it is a common view of analysts on both the left and the right. The left critique of regulation originates with the work of historian Gabriel Coco, whose 1963 book, The Triumph of Conservatism, argues that the regulatory reforms of the progressive era were really a response to demands by big business that the federal government rationalize ruinous competition. Now, John D. Rockefeller made an observation. Old John D. said, competition is a sin. What he was involved in is monopoly, and the USDA is the manifestation of agribusiness monopoly. And this monopoly was designed with a specific purpose, and it's to drive every farmer off the land. And of course, that conforms perfectly with the two penal clause statutes or chapters in the Bible, Leviticus 26 and Deuteronomy 28. You know, in the final analysis, you know, you can blame the communists, or you can blame the USDA, you can point your fingers at the Republicans, or report on the Democrats. But in the final analysis, it's God Almighty Himself that has driven the farmers off the land. And He drove you farmers off the land because you would not practice the 15 agricultural laws. You gave Him the finger and said, we're not going to have this God to rule over us. We're going to have George Bush, Bill Clinton. We're going to have farm subsidies, stocks, bonds, negotiable instruments, chemical fertilizers, and pesticides and sprays. We're going to have scientific agriculture. We're going to turn agriculture into an industrial commodity. And we did, and there's a result. There's a broken law and there's a penalty to pay. And I'm just a reporter, so I wanted to tell you. You can point your fingers at Republicans, Democrats, communists, and you can say, well, the communists are going to save us. Boys and girls, the Democrats and the Republicans working together have destroyed you. What makes you think the communists, socialists, or some other political ideology is going to save you? Save you out of the hand of God Himself? Well, like you're whistling Dixie through a straw hat. Quite the contrary. In reaching and reacting to the victories of the agrarian populace of the late 19th century, the corporate community saw its primary and immediate need was to co-opt the fledgling populist movement, and thus it acceded to the birth of the progressive era. And although that era did produce some legislation that answered the populists' demand for democratic economic reform, the managers of that era managed to sidestep the fundamental issue, corporate power, particularly because at the same time that power was trying its level best to drag agriculture kicking and screaming into the nation's industrial revolution, the industrialization of agriculture. And they succeeded, and the farmers went along with it. They didn't resist. Also, contrary to Colco's analysis, which the USDA Incorporated appears to accept, the so-called regulatory reforms of the progressive era were not necessarily a response to demands by big business that the federal government rationalize ruinous competition, but rather it was an effort to frame the question in terms of good trusts and bad trusts. And thus they came up with legislation that would regulate the bad trusts, rather than to admit that trusts in and of themselves are bad for farmers, bad for consumers. And in the years since the progressive era, the courts and the politically sensitive Department of Justice, along with the corporate-friendly policies of USDA, have managed to successfully create corporate concentrations beyond anything imagined by those who initiated our first antitrust laws. And at the same time, the reactionary forces that have always stood shoulder to shoulder with the USDA policy and policymakers have systematically waged a campaign to bury the progressive pro-farmer measures that the agrarian populists instituted, driving the final nail in the coffin with the passage of the Freedom Farm Act in 1996. Yeah, that's right, 1996, the Freedom Farm Act, the last nail in the coffin of the family farmer. Remember, it was passed by a Republican Congress and signed by a Democrat president, Bill Clinton. Hey, it's the Republicans and Democrats working together. And they had an objective. Get this, 80% of all of the meat processed in the United States of America is done by three corporations. Three corporations control 80% of the meat. This is a monopoly that John D. Rockefeller couldn't have imagined. It's the demise of the family farmer, but there's a cause and effect relationship. Now let me tell you a little story. It's called Jefferson, Corporations and the Constitution. It was written by Charles Beard back in 1936. It was published by the National Home Library Foundation. But it's a story that deals with corporate power in America. Where did this corporate power in America arise from? Copyrighted clear back in 1936. That's before I was born. That's before most of you listening to me right now are born. And in the story, under the dual system of equal rights for natural persons and for corporate persons, the American economy has passed over the long road from the days of the fathers to the latest hour. For readers of this journal, it is not necessary to describe even briefly the present situation. They are familiar with such surveys of contemporary economy as may be found in Burl and Means, the modern corporation and private property, But nearly 80% of the business wealth of the nation is concentrated in the hands of corporations, and about 49% of the corporate wealth and 38% of the business wealth is in the hands of 200 corporations in a nation of 120 million natural persons. Now think of that. Think of that statement. We've got to take a break here a minute. 80% of the business wealth, clear back in 1936, was in the hands of corporations. Half of the business wealth, 49% of that corporate wealth, was in the hands of 200 corporations back in 1936. 38% of the business wealth is in the hands of 200 corporations. We're not talking about Fortune 500 and the monopoly of ADM and Cargill in the 1990s. We're talking about monopoly, clear back in the 1930s. Now, what do you think it is today? More or less? Stand by. I'll be right back. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, with an income of $50,000, you're paying about $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Well, then, shouldn't you subtract that $7,650 from your $50,000 income and then pay your income tax on the $42,350 balance instead of paying 17% of that $50,000 twice? Now, you know the IRS makes you pay 15.3% of that $50,000 in Social Security tax, and then they make you pay 17% of the same $50,000 in income tax. That means you're paying 17% of that $7,650 twice. Now, that little bookkeeping trick steals an extra $1,300 from everyone who pays this tax. Now, what would you think if Sears Pennies or your credit card company charged you twice, like Social Security and the IRS does? Now, don't you think that's just kind of special? For more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is also available in compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about the family farmer. What happened to the American family farmer? His numbers have decreased from 45 million in 1920 to 2 million today. Most people think that's a good thing. Why, look at all of the good that's come from all these farmers being moved from the country to the city. Why, they got concrete under their feet and they've got a better standard of living. And who is it that owns all of their land? The multinational corporations like ADM and John Hancock Insurance. Well, John D. Rockefeller would have been proud. He said competition is a sin. He was a monopolist. And of course, that's what we have in agriculture today. It's a monopoly. And this monopoly was described in a book called Jefferson on Corporations. Jefferson, Corporations, and the Constitution by Dr. Charles A. Beard. At the break, I showed you that 80% of the business wealth of the nation is concentrated in the hands of corporations. 50% of the corporate wealth and 40% of the business wealth is in the hands of just 200 corporations. In a nation of 120 million natural persons. Now, drive down the street. As you're driving down the strip, you'll look off to one hand and you'll see Winchell's Donuts, and over on the other hand, it's the other side is Get and Go, and over here is Walmart, and over there is Target, and so on. Every one of these businesses on Main Street are corporations. There aren't any private businesses out there. Oh, there's a few. You know, I operate a private business here in my law school, but most people have corporations, trusts, foundations, or some other kind of government-created entity. What it means is you can't own it. And that's what the first plank of the Communist Manifesto is all about. It's there for the express purpose of denying private ownership of any type of property to individuals. You can own it in a group. You can own it in a trust. You can have a condominium. You can have a mortgage, but you can't own it yourself. Now he goes on to say, back in 1936, nor is it necessary to speak of the achievements of corporations in amassing great capital far beyond the reach of any natural person and in developing great industrial, commercial, and transportation enterprises. And nor is it necessary to recite the story of corporate abuses, such as stock watering, holding company pyramiding, underground lobbying, and all of the rest. Painful incidents and the revelations of many congressional investigations are already too poignantly in the minds of informed persons. The question is, what's the upshot? Hey, listen, that sounds like it came out of the Wall Street Journal yesterday, doesn't it? Enron collapses, WorldCom and Global Crossing, stock pyramiding, corporate scandal. Yeah, what's going on in 1936? Nothing's changed. The same kind of criminal behavior that's going on today was going on then. The question is not easy to answer, but a few relevant facts may be set down for consideration. Now listen to this. America is not a nation of home-owning and independent farmers, as envisioned by Jefferson. America is mainly a nation of industrial workers, white-collar employees, debt-burdened farmers, tenants, sharecroppers, and casual laborers. And the opportunity for natural persons to acquire physical property, to manage that property, operate that property, and enjoy the fruits of that property in security has materially declined. The household arts, which enabled farmers and their wives to guarantee security to themselves, have practically vanished. Nearly all of the owners of small properties, such as stores, garages, gasoline stands, and pants-pressing establishments, are pitifully dependent for survival, to say nothing of a living, upon the general state of the economy of the nation. And finally, it is to be noted that the old days when America furnished vast quantities of raw materials and farm produce to the developing capitalism of Europe have long passed. The whole balance of world economy has shifted since 1787. Indeed, it has shifted significantly since 1890. And hence, even corporate enterprise finds itself hampered, blocked, and harassed in the quest for markets, domestic and foreign, in which to sell the flooding output of its vast technology. Isn't that what we see from China and Japan? The vast output of their technology? Toyotas coming to America from Japan, and tennis shoes from China, the outsourcing of American jobs to India and Pakistan. Now, they go on to tell us, surely none will deny the immensity of this transformation in the economy, in which natural persons are to enjoy the natural rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And surely none will deny the disparity between individual natural persons and individual corporate persons in wealth, economic power, and political influence. If the corporate person is to enjoy all of the rights of natural persons, then the dice of fortune are loaded on its side. If corporations cannot provide employment for the millions of the American proletariat, for such we have, in spite of all the claptrap to the contrary, can corporate persons expect to protect themselves forever through constitutional and judicial processes against the distresses and distempers of natural persons twisting and turning in their search for the rights to life, to liberty, and property declared in the American Creed? Think of that. You know, today, in the year 2004, we're struggling to keep our jobs. They're being exported to India. And it's the corporations that are doing that. It's not mom and pop down on the farm. It's Cargill and ADM. The multinational corporations are buying soybeans from Brazil and shipping them into the United States in competition to the American family farmer. The purpose is to drive the last of the family farmers out of business. We're going to create a world market. ADM produces soybeans in Iowa. ADM produces soybeans in Brazil. ADM produces cattle in Argentina. ADM produces cattle in Iowa. The last thing we need is farmers in Iowa competing with ADM in their world monopoly. And the United States Department of Agriculture is a partner with ADM and Cargill and the multinationals to drive you out of business. That's the bottom line. And that's not good news for consumers either. You see, once we've driven the competition out, then we'll tell you what you're going to pay. In Europe, they pay $5.60 a gallon for gasoline. And the time is coming when you're going to pay $5.60 a gallon for gasoline in the United States. When the fascists take control, when the New World Order is put into operation, do you think that all of this competition from the multinationals, do you think that all of this stifling of competition is going to benefit consumers? You know, we used to have in this country 15 or 20 airlines. Today we're down to about 5. We used to have 2,600 car companies. Today we have 3. And one of those is foreign-owned. Chrysler was bought out by a German company. You've really only got 2 American car companies left. And this trend in banks and in agriculture, it's throughout the economy. It's nothing that you and I are going to stop. But I'll tell you this, working for corporate America is not where the future lies. It's in private business, and it lies in gold and silver. You know, that's what God told us years ago. He told us that through the pen of Moses. He said, listen, I got a program. Follow this program, and I'll pour you out a blessing. There won't be room enough to receive it. Give me the finger, and I'll bury you. America's family farmers have been buried, and you've been buried not by the Republicans or Democrats. They're just the vehicles that God used to do it. You were buried by God Almighty himself in exactly the same way that he buried the Egyptians, 3,100 or, in this case, about 4,000 years ago. When Joseph was the chief architect of the economy in Egypt, he was used to bury those Egyptians, deprive them of their land. That's what's happened in America. Now, at our Constitutional Convention in 1787, we had John Adams, who made an observation. This is no strange doctrine for American ears. Jefferson knew that nations are not immortal, and that governments are transient, and that concentrated wealth and widespread poverty cannot forever endure side by side in a democracy. Well, James Madison made this observation. Listen to this. Madison was equally well acquainted with the long story of mankind, and he also warned his countrymen of perils to come. And he said, in the Constitutional Convention of 7 August 1787, Madison said this, quote, in future times, a great majority of the people will not only be without landed, but any other sort of property. Did you hear that? In future times, a great majority of the people of America will not only be without landed, but any other sort of property. That's the first plank to the Communist Manifesto. Did you think Madison was a prophet sent by God? Now, he said plainly, if these corporations are allowed to grow up side by side with individual entrepreneurs, the corporations will take over and drive the individual entrepreneurs out of business. And that's precisely what's occurred. Now, you and I can compete. We can compete with big corporate agribusiness. I have cattle. I sell them individually and privately to other individuals, and I get the retail price for them. I'm not selling my price and my cows in competition with Tyson Meats. I can't compete with them, but I can sell an organic product. I can sell a better product for more money, and I can do it as a private family farmer. And there's about 4,000 of these little private family farms working in America, and they make $100,000 a year. That's more than you're going to make at your factory job. So you ought to be thinking about that. We got to take a break here. Stand by. We'll be right back with more on whatever happened to the family farmer when we come back. Stand by. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. You know, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But just what is it that the government is doing, or what does it do to produce, prepare, or deliver, for which government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the guy in the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on a pizza that he has to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit and eat it? Just why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and services that you and I buy? Well, for more information about tax and status, just call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. And be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Tax and status is also available on compact disc for adult homeschool. And if you're online, you can go to my website, georgegordon.org. Click on the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. You know, if you want to truly show how historically remiss the U.S. Department of Agriculture has been in serving its primary constituency, the family farmer, then a thorough examination of the rampant discrimination against minority farmers, washing its hands of any responsibility for the plight of the men and women and children who harvest and process our food, and its dubious role in underwriting corporate research with taxpayer dollars through the land grant colleges and extension services, as laid out in detail in the 1971 Hard Tomatoes, Hard Time Study by the Agribusiness Accountability Project. It's indispensable to your understanding. None of these issues are dealt with in any substantive way in this paper called The USDA Incorporated. It's also misleading, as the paper, The USDA Incorporated, illustrates, to suggest that the Department of Agriculture's revolving door and its influence on the USDA decision making over the past decade is anyway out of character for the agency or of recent origin. The influence of corporate agribusiness today in the halls of the Department of Agriculture could be argued is mere child's play compared to the role that it has played in the past in shaping our nation's farm and food policies to benefit the agribusiness, the multinational corporations, at the expense of the family farmer. During World War II, the chief lobbyist and manager in Washington, D.C. for the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives, popularly known as the Co-op Council, which for many years was recognized as one of the nation's premier farm organizations. The guy that headed it was Ezra Taft Benson. Benson would later serve as President Dwight D. Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture from 1953 to 61. And in 1985, Benson became the 13th prophet and president of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, popularly called the Mormons. Itself is a multi-billion dollar a year corporate agribusiness establishment. While succeeding Benson at the Co-op Council, which included a broad spectrum of commodity interests represented through scores of affiliates and thousands of co-ops, was John H. Davis. In the late 1940s, Davis left the co-op council to become manager of the National Wool Marketing Corporation, a co-op which at the time handled about 95% of the nation's wool supply. As you can see, these co-ops, corporations, are multi-billion dollar multinationals. They may be called co-ops, but those are corporations, boys and girls, and they make policy, and they make policy with the USDA. In fact, they control the Department of Agriculture, and they're in business to promote the businesses and the business of corporate agribusiness. With Eisenhower's election in 52, Davis accepted a post as Assistant Secretary of Agriculture in charge of price supports and marketing. He resigned that position in 1954 to become the first director of the Moffitt Program in Business and Agriculture, an effort by the Harvard Business School, endowed with $300,000 by the Corn Products Refining Corporation, later known as CPC International, to improve relations between farmers and businessmen. Put another way, to work on the improvements in the relations between the small family farmers and the corporate agribusinessmen. Writing in the January-February 1956 issue of the Harvard Business Review, Davis suggested that the time had come for a movement which would advocate the concept of vertical integration as the alternative to big government programs to help agriculture. And he called such a movement agribusiness. Use the name agribusiness. In the dynamic era ahead, the term farm problem will become more and more a misnomer. Farm problems will be recognized as being also business problems and vice versa. More precisely, farm problems will be agribusiness problems. Well, boys and girls, what we're listening to here is the Hegelian dialectics. We create a problem, we propose a solution, and create synthesis. That's what's going on here. It's worked perfectly. It's driven all of the family farmers off the land. Tell me that it hasn't succeeded. You thought that the USDA was there to keep family farmers on the land and to keep family farms in business. No, the objective was to drive the family farmers off the land, put them out of business, so that the big multinational corporations would have no competition. We called it the farm problem, and we hung a lot of names on it and labels on it, and then we came up with farm programs to help the family farmers. These help the family farmer programs were policies designed to destroy America's family farms. In the same way that we want to help the public schools, that we have programs for public education. You know, we didn't have a farm problem in 1900. We didn't have an education problem in 1900 until the government got involved. Then we developed an education problem and a farm problem. And today the family farmers have been driven off of the farms and the public school children can't read and write. Yep. Looks like to me that Hegelian dialectics has worked like a shot, don't you? Well, no, it is significant that the concept agribusiness would come out of the closet and into common usage during the Eisenhower presidency and in the decade of Benson's farm policy, for that conjunction and its economic and political consequences reverberates to this day through the entire structure of American agriculture. At about the same time, 13 agricultural economists, including Chairman O.B. Jesnes, Murray R. Benedict, Earl L. Butts, he was later a Secretary of Agriculture, Edwin G. Norse, and T.W. Schultz, many of whom would later advise and serve in the Eisenhower-Benson administration, were recommending in a Farm Foundation report, turning the searchlight on farm policy, a forthright analysis of experience, lessons, criteria, and recommendations that, if the effort to equalize income of farm and non-farm groups takes the form of continuous cash supplements or subsidies rather than returns for the market, this means that resources, especially labor resources, are being used in agriculture when they could be used more profitably in other lines. We must therefore seek better means for promoting economic equality for agriculture. And they did. Just go back to the ninth plank to the Communist Manifesto. They implemented the ninth plank to the Communist Manifesto, worked like a shot, and drove all of the family farmers off the land, which is precisely what Joseph did to the Egyptians. Specifically, the report suggested free market clearing prices and the scrapping of the parity price formula that had been used in farm legislation since 1932, ready and equal access to capital, for example, credit for all producers, free managerial choices, for example, free from government regulatory control, a safeguard against depression through stop-loss direct supplementary income payments if depression occurred, and a separate program for non-commercial farmers. Their suggestions for structural change included educational institutions, which should provide adequate training for workers of all grades and should use their facilities to urge the movement of farm people away from situations where labor returns in farming fall below that in other comparable occupations. We need to encourage and develop prompt adaptation and flexible reduction of farmers' efforts to constantly changing conditions. This principle of voluntary adjustment is based and basic to our system of free enterprise, they told us. This is intervention in the marketplace. And it comes under a doctrine called Hale versus Hinkle and Wickard versus Filbert. Well, they concluded that the basic theme of this report is that our foreign policy needs to be realistically shaped to the conditions developing for the future rather than continue as a legacy from the past. Frankly, we think that the evolution of national foreign policies has now brought agriculture into a position of undue reliance on public financial assistance, on efforts to restrict market supplies, and into undesirable political involvement. Well, that's an understatement. Political involvement. You take farming out of the marketplace. You take it out of free enterprise and you put it in government. It's the same program that they had in Russia. They called them in Russia five-year plans. Five-year plans. In the United States, we call it the farm problem. We call it farm policy. The farm program. And we bring the government in to regulate and control it. And when you sign up for a guardian ward relationship in which the government then regulates you under these two doctrines called Hale versus Hinkle and Wickard versus Filbert. We'll take a break here in a minute and we'll have to take a look at Hale versus Hinkle. It was first decided by the U.S. Supreme Court back in 1905. It's cited at 201 U.S. 43, Hale versus Hinkle, H-E-N-K-E-L, in which the Supreme Court made a couple of three neat observations. One observation they made was that the grand jury system in the United States was nothing more than a prosecutorial tool. Our old common law system of grand juries and petite juries has been subverted, again, by our government. It's not subverted because of God's ineptitudes. It was subverted by our government. We got our jury system, you know, from God Almighty at Mount Sinai. We got our judicial system from God Almighty at Mount Sinai. We did not get a political system. We got a judicial system. And the court in 1905 explained to us what happens when you join this guardian ward relationship and you join corporate capacity. So hang on, we'll take a break here, and we'll be right back with Hale versus Hinkle right after this. All right, you're listening to The Law. We're an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs encompass the second and the eighth planks to the Communist Manifesto. That's a foreign and alien ideology to America. Traditional American values are individual responsibility in place of Social Security and tithing in place of the income tax. Now, these foreign and alien ideologies require of us that we violate three of the Ten Commandments and eight statutes of the Old Covenant. We're taught to covet our neighbor's property and then call that income redistribution. We steal from our neighbors with unjust weights and measures called Federal Reserve Notes, and then we practice idolatry by signing contracts with these foreign and alien gods called government. We call those 1040 forms. And you know, we're not getting away with our crimes either. We're now paying up to 74% of everything we create and produce in taxes. We live in mortgaged homes owned by the savings and loan companies. We drive cars that are owned by GMAC or Ford Motor Finance. The average family of four has a $70,000 consumer debt. We owe a $6 trillion national debt. We're surety for another $44 trillion of unfunded government obligations. Our financial institutions are leveraged out to $60 trillion worldwide. Our Social Security retirement system is a chain letter Ponzi scheme. We live from paycheck to paycheck, and then we're taught to call all of that prosperity. Well, you know, the God of Israel gave us a better way than that, and our founding fathers followed that better way in our Constitution. Now, if you'd like to learn more about tax and status and a better way of life, why don't you call and order my four-hour compact disc package? It's educational, it's entertaining, informative, best of all, it's free. Doesn't cost a dime. We can call right now. The number's 417-273-4967 and order your free package. If you're online, just go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. We're called direct 417-273-4967. All right, when we took the break, we were up to Hale versus Hinkle, cited at 201 U.S. 53 on page 75. Listen to this. As they say down at the Blue Room, read them and weep. The court tells us that conceding that the witness was an officer of the corporation under investigation and that he was entitled to assert the rights of the corporation with respect to the production of its books and papers, we're of the opinion that there's a clear distinction in this particular between an individual and a corporation, and that the latter has no right to refuse to submit its books and papers for an examination at the suit of the state. Ah. Hale versus Hinkle, the American Tobacco Company versus the United States Internal Revenue Service, 1905. The American Tobacco Company walks in and says, wait a minute, we got a Fourth Amendment right to protect here. You can't have our records and books without a warrant. The Supreme Court says, there's a clear distinction here between an individual, that is the family farmer, Joe Sixpack, and his wife Sally, and a corporate agribusiness like ADM. There's a clear distinction. Now, of course, old Joe Sixpack decided to incorporate. Most of you farmers out there are incorporated. And when you did that, you did something legally fatal. Legally fatal. Well, the court goes on and tells us a little more. It says the individual, this is Joe Sixpack Farmer, may stand upon his constitutional rights as a citizen. Joe Sixpack Farmer is entitled to carry on his private business in his own way. Joe Sixpack Farmer has power to contract, and it's unlimited. Joe Sixpack Farmer owes no duty to the state or to his neighbors to divulge his business or to open his doors to an investigation, so far as it may tend to incriminate him. And he owes no such duty to the state since he receives nothing therefrom, beyond the protection of his life and property. His rights are such as existed by the law of the land, long antecedent to the organization of the state, and can only be taken from him by due process of law, and in accordance with the Constitution. Among his rights are a refusal to incriminate himself and the immunity of himself and his property from arrest or seizure, except under a warrant of the law. He owes nothing to the public so long as he does not trespass upon their rights. Joe Sixpack Farmer has rights. Joe Sixpack Farmer can contract. His power to contract is unlimited. Well, what do you think happens to you, Joe, when you incorporate? Does anything change? Yeah? Yeah, Joe, it does. It changes pretty dramatically. Upon the other hand, the corporation is a creature of the state. The corporation is presumed to be incorporated for the benefit of the public. The corporation receives certain special franchises and privileges and holds them subject to the laws of the state and the limitations of its charter. The corporation's powers are limited by law. The corporation can make no contract not authorized by its charter. The corporation's rights to act as a corporation are only preserved to it so long as it obeys the laws of its creation. And there is a reserved right in the legislature to investigate its contracts and to find out whether it has exceeded its powers. It would be a strange anomaly to hold that a state, having chartered a corporation to make use of certain franchises, could not, in the exercise of its sovereignty, inquire as to how those franchises had been employed and whether they had been abused, and then demand the production of the corporate books and papers for that purpose. Corporations do not have rights. Corporations have privileges and immunities granted by the legislature. So when the legislature, the Congress, creates the USDA, and the USDA comes out and contracts with you, then the USDA and Joe Sixpack Farmer enter into a contract. This creates a guardian-ward relationship. And then when you went to your attorney said, no, Joe, gosh, you don't want to face a strict liability. You want limited liability under a corporate contract. So you incorporate. You create a corporation. I don't know of any, or very many, I guess I know of a few, but I don't know of very many farmers that aren't incorporated. There's a few family farmers around that are still operating under the name of Don Jones or Sam Smith or George Gordon, but they're relatively few. Those of us that do that have rights. Our rights are guaranteed by the Constitution. I don't sign contracts with the FDA, the USDA, or with government at any level for any cause or reason. And that's because George Gordon is competent. I'm legally competent. I'm medically competent. I can take care of myself. I don't need government. I don't need a guardian. I don't need the bank to count my money, or the doctor to tell me what pills to take, or the government to tell me what to plant and what to sell. I can figure that out all by myself. I know it's a wild new concept, but you know, I'm one of the few guys in America. I'm one of the few farmers in America that's not complaining about farm prices. Gosh, I sell my product at retail. I'm just as happy as a clam at high tide. Now, I teach a class on how to make $100,000 a year on 25 acres or less. Now, if you're a farmer out there, like one I had come down here to school, was farming 15 sections of wheat up in North Dakota. 15 sections. My God, that was 9,600 acres. 15 square miles for you people in the city. Can you imagine that? 15 square miles. Guy farms this every year. Grows wheat on it. Multi-million dollar a year operation. Came down here and says, geez, I'm losing $100,000 a year. I said, I got a solution for that. Retire. He didn't think that was very funny. He went back to North Dakota and kept on farming. About 7 years later, the bank said, we're not rolling your note over. Put him into Chapter 7 and put him out of his misery. He simply stayed in the farming business until he consumed all of the equity that he had in his farming operation. Bad business, bad farming. But that's the way a lot of people are, and it was a corporation. Now, if you want to farm in corporate America under the Commerce Clause at Article 1, Section 8, and then go out and compete with ADM and Tyson Cargill and the big multinational corporations, hey, listen, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. Get right after it. My observation is I couldn't compete with them, and I kind of doubt that you can either, especially since government and business are united in their objective to put you out of business. Now, there's one more facet or factor that comes in here. It's called Wickard versus Filburn. Decided back in the 1940s, late 30s and early 40s. The case was filed about 1942. This guy, Filburn, signed a contract with the USDA. It was a price support contract. He got 96 cents a bushel for his wheat, but he was limited to 20 acres. So he went out and planted his 20 acres in 38, 39, 40, harvested them, sold them for 96 cents a bushel, got paid with taxpayer largesse. And then one year he decided that he would plant 40 acres. So he did. And the Secretary of Agriculture, Wickard, got wind of it and fined him and prosecuted him. He took the case clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. And he said, this is America, the land of the free, the home of the brave. Why, this is a free market. Well, I've got rights. Well, I've got a right to plant whatever I want to. And besides that, I didn't violate the contract. I planted 20 acres of wheat and sold it to the government. I planted a second 20 acres of wheat and I fed it to my turkeys. And the Supreme Court came back and said the purpose of the price support program was to limit the production of wheat. It's a marketing tool, the court said. Wickard versus Filburn. It's cited at 317 U.S. 111. You need to read it. 317 U.S. 111. Landmark case. Landmark case. And the court went on to say it's hardly lack of due process or equal protection of law for government to regulate that which it subsidizes. If you want to tie in to the candy canes and the lollipops, then you're going to be regulated and controlled by that same government that signed the contract. You see, that's the objective. And what we do is we come over here and government offers you a lollipop. It offers you the taxpayer lollipop, the free corn. Then, pretty shortly, the farmers become dependent upon the free corn, and they're no longer able to go out and rustle up acorns, root out roots, and find their own snakes to eat. The farmers, who used to be individual and free, have now been tamed and penned up and shipped off to market. And the guys that are profiting off of the small independent farmers are the big multinational corporations. You see, they come in along with the banks, foreclose on you, and take all your toys away from you. It was a part and parcel with the plan clear back at the turn of the century. And it was advanced with expedience in the 1930s with the Roosevelt administration. And now with the Clinton years, they simply closed the gate. That's what happened in 96 with the latest Freedom Farm Program. They just closed the gate, boys and girls. It's all over. Read them and weep. That's that story. Well, we're about out of time. We'll wrap it up right there. And I'll be back here again tomorrow night, same time, same station. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. Now, for more information, just go to the homeschooling page on the website. It's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Well, there's the signal that says my time is up. I'll have to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing. So until then, good night, friends.